There we are. We're live. Welcome to another episode of the PBJ. How are you guys doing?
Great.
What's up, dudes?
We already got someone ready to go. Let's go.
Yeah.
Go.
It's unusual for me. You know, typically I'm there live with Steve, so I'm sad that I don't see the chat. So Steve, you're gonna have to let us know what's going on.
I got to own it. All right.
Yeah. Let us know what's happening. Yes. I guess Max is very good about attendance. He gets the perfect attendance award until today.
Renee Aaron 21 says, let's go.
Let's go.
Let's go.
Get it going.
Let's do it.
We got lots to chat about.
I'm excited to talk about something Austria's cooked up. So
let us know.
A few weeks ago, we announced the PB Media Archive and gave a really cool way to either just look up by topic what we've talked about and point to all the different episodes and the timestamps within the episodes, or you do like an AI search. So like last week, maybe earlier this week, I'm like, oh, I'd love to know like what's the sort of topic distribution of our show over time. Like how much do we talk about energy and AI and Bitcoin and various subsegments of those? So I poked around a little bit actually, and we're using Buzz now with PBJ. So I was like asking AI to like generate some pie charts and different visualizations to toy with it. Kind of liked what I saw, handed it off to Ashu, and he's built it into the product now, into the website. So if you go to, what is it, pbarchive.ai/topics, you can see. And I think, Ashu, are you ready to show it? Yeah, we're going to show it live here. It's pretty hot. I think it's awesome.
Are these the one where he like superimposed it over the video stream?
Well, he did that for a video clip, which worked well.
But that was like post-production.
We're going to do... That was post-production.
Pretty hot. Are you Paris Hilton now, Steve? What is this?
Oh, is that her saying or something?
I mean, 20 years ago. I don't know.
All right. Well...
She was named one of the most important people in AI recently, so that's good for you.
But Jensen was not. Didn't he miss the list?
Something like that.
So here it is, the PBJ Topic Explorer. So you can see here, beautiful...
I'm going to zoom in a little bit.
Yeah, I can't.
Can you hear? They're asking to zoom it in.
Oh, nice. Oh, dude, this is
nice.
Oh, that's cool. Yep.
So, yeah, you can see all these different categories. The count and share of topic transcript topic matches.
All right.
And then, right now AI and agents is highlighted as a cluster. So if you scroll down a little bit, you go down to the selected cluster and it breaks it down further.
Right. Nice.
We did notice there's
OpenClaw.
Yeah.
So there's notice like Buzz and Goose are missing. So Ashu already identified an issue there, so he's gonna be fixing that. But otherwise I didn't really notice anything wrong with it. And then at the bottom there, there's pointers to episodes where we talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
And then if you bounce back up, Ashu, then you can pick, what should we pick? Custody, wallets, and privacy. Let's pick that, go down, and then you get that selected cluster. So
interesting.
You can see various things we talked about. So it's pretty cool, right?
It's interesting though, like, for example, I'm curious, like BitChat, like why it put that there under wallets. That seems a little interesting. I mean, the other ones all make sense though.
Yeah. So anyone listening that finds this interesting, play around with it. If you see any taxonomy problems, please let us know. I'm sure there's some
nice there. Like, it's very visually appealing.
Yeah, well rendered.
Yeah.
And then if you can go back up, please. And then up to the first chart. And then click on trends. You can see over time. The topics distribution, for the most part, we're consistent. I mean, there's an increasing trend line of AI, but it's not like we started talking about AI in 2026. We've talked about AI all along.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So go back to Q1 2025. You know, we're spending, 10-15% of our time.
Is that the green one on the left? That's kind of the AI bar.
Yeah, you can click only, and then now that just shows AI.
Yeah, interesting.
And what's that next one? Is that Bitcoin or something?
No, payments, lightning, and stablecoin. Okay, are you able to see the categories?
A little bit. Yeah, it's little small, but yeah, I can kind of get a scroll.
Okay.
Yeah, DK's got.
We got this new 65-inch display in the studio. Yeah. So
it is pretty sweet, actually.
Even my old eyes can now read all of the text.
Shout out to Alex for that. That thing is dope.
Yep. Big win there. Yeah. So great job.
Cool.
Yeah, I think this is awesome. Hope people enjoy it. The other thing
Do you think this thing is close to a state where it could be like available for other podcasts? Because I feel like this would be an interesting tool to be able to, like, if you run a separate podcast, if you could kind of drop in maybe a URL to YouTube or RSS or something and then kind of get these kinds of stats back.
Well, that's what Steve shared with us, right? That's that radar thing.
Well, there's two things here. So I believe, is the code open source? Okay. Well, we can potentially open source the code. I mean, the philosophy here at PB is definitely to open source it. So yeah, we can talk about open sourcing this, and we'll talk to Ashu about the sort of the state of that code for others to use it. I mean, it was all vibe coded. So
what isn't these days?
What isn't these days? Yeah. So I think that could be, something positive we could do.
I'd also be curious, just Ashu, if you're hearing this, two of the things that would be fun to see that'd be interesting for a lot of people is like some of the metrics, like download metrics over time. So like, you know, as we talk more about certain topics, you know, do the downloads go up or down? Is it like new listeners, old listeners? Also some of the sort of like, as a Spotify artist, you can always see where your listeners are from, their demographics. I'd be curious to see all that. And then particularly for the Bitcoin or I guess payment enabled podcast, the, you know, Fountain style podcast, I'd be curious to see sort of metrics. I'm sure all of the podcasts in that world around streaming and which episodes get zapped, that sort of stuff too.
Well, Max, do you read Ashu's quarterly report?
No.
Well, there you go. You've been doing this for a year now.
Well, anyways, it'd be cool if that were part of the product.
Yeah, it's not a real-time dashboard, but it's he does put together a quarterly report.
That's sweet.
Cool. Thanks for showing that, and great work. Now, so DK, you asked, could this be used for other podcasts? Maybe. I mean, I think we should open source it and
see what happens.
Now, separately, I just noticed I think it was yesterday, that a startup called Particle announced a new product called Radar, which is like a podcast search tool. And it just reminded me of the work we've been doing this. But ours is just focused on PB Media, and this tool has indexed many podcasts. I don't know if it's hundreds or thousands, but that means a lot of podcasts they've ingested. And I think their goal is to ingest all the world's podcasts. PBJ was ingested, but at least 10 of our episodes. That's cool. And let's see. Yeah. So it's ingested all the transcripts of these podcasts. You can search over them with AI, very reminiscent of this. I know the founder, so I messaged her some of the work we've done too, including these newest visualizations. And I think, I'm like, feel free to steal them, add them. So we'll see what happens there. But I think it's super cool. I mean, we're doing it for our show, but yeah, I think it's like a great service for the world to do it for all shows. It's always puzzled me, especially having worked at Google for almost a decade, how the world never has searched video and audio content very well. It's bizarre.
Yeah, that is weird, actually.
I mean, it should have been the case years ago that whatever you type into the Google search box, you get fantastic audio and video content as well, and that's not really.
Yeah, and you should be able to get it like to the clip or to the segment where the interesting thing is happening that's very relevant. Like there could be a 3-hour podcast, and you might actually want to dive into 2 hours and 11 minutes where they talk about the topic you care about.
And I'm actually particularly surprised because podcasting is sort of one of the last open protocols left with not RSS, but is it RSS?
Yeah,
it's RSS. So like honestly, that should make it even easier now that anyone should be able to do this.
Yeah. So and just like PB Media Archive, Radar also delivers that timestamp granularity, which is phenomenal, right? So let's see.
Is that designed as a consumer product or like an API or some of each right now, or where's that going?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. It's definitely it has a consumer feel to the website. I mean, I used it a little bit last night. So definitely not AI only, but I could imagine it being a service for AI as well.
I think about these tools, like you've seen like Exa and Parallel are effectively search engines for kind of tool use, for agents to kind of tool use search. And this seems like it could be another case where you'd want an agent to be able to tool use podcast search. That seems like a more likely flow to kind of get in the mainstream of usage versus transitioning behavior to when you know you're doing a podcast search going to a specific place. And certainly like agents are doing, I think, on track to do more searches than humans if they haven't already crossed that threshold.
Yep. There definitely needs to be some kind of business model involved because, I mean, with PB Media Archive, you know, it's just one podcast and we don't get a whole lot of traffic to the website. So we can eat the cost of the LLM. But, you know, if you're trying to deliver a service that for searching all podcasts and grow it and have lots of users, whether they be agents or humans, there's going to be some real costs behind that. So there needs to be some kind of gate or business model. And I think they do. They give some free usage now and then they rate limit after a while. I think they're trying to figure that out. But you know, maybe there's an opportunity here for, you know, payments as well, you know, be it stablecoins or Bitcoin, like an X402, L402 type of standard where, whether you're a human or agent doesn't really matter, but you have to pay up a micropayment to access it.
Yeah. And we talked about last week, Albie's new product, TaskFuel.ai, which is also effectively a search engine for agents to find paid APIs or paid services. So if someone wants to do this with any of the 402 protocols, they speak all the same and I'm sure they would index immediately. So.
Yeah. I was just happy to see this because, you know, a month ago when we launched PB Media Archive, I was tweeting out saying like, you know, kind of like, haha, we're the only podcast with this, but everyone else should too. Who's next?
Yeah.
And so it's nice to see a tool that said not only, you know, one podcast is next, but all the podcasts are next. So, you know, and then it's someone I know too. So that's pretty cool.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's great.
So I mean, as we learn more over time, we'll update on the show.
Cool. Guys, one thing I wanted to jump in on, a little bit of, I suppose, an alpha drop for the listeners, something that's top of mind for me. I shared this in the chat. I don't know. Did you guys see the Voya announcement? Did y'all read about that at all that I shared?
I saw it. Was that, that was in the new chat, not the old chat, right?
This wasn't the old chat. This was before I got all of my, my public private key information erased and back up, which by the way, we'll talk more about, now I'm buzz working and it's sick. But yeah, so this is a story that I'm extremely excited about. I mean, it's personal and, you know, very clearly talking my own book here as I'm an investor in this company, but I'm an investor because I think it's, you know, one of the most world-changing technologies and companies I've ever seen. And so I think it's just worth highlighting, since we talked a lot about energy in the past, why this is such a big deal. So if you guys didn't see, Voya announced a Series A fundraise this week, Voya Energy, and it's, in my opinion, one of the most transformative technologies and ideas they're going after. It's very simple, but it's something that we've known is possible theoretically, but hasn't been done, you know, in decades. And so the idea is, you know, we talked a lot about how long duration storage is the big problem for energy, particularly long duration, location independent, easily transportable energy storage. And if you think about what's the best form of long duration, location independent, flexible or transportable energy storage, it's hydrocarbons, right? So, you know, batteries are great.
I was told it was Bitcoin a few years ago.
Well, it's big. I mean, sort of. Not exactly, but it's in the same, although in that same paper in Bitcoin is Key to an Abundant Clean Energy Future, we talked a lot about green hydrogen. And you know, it's really interesting, Sarah. So the idea is that as solar gets super cheap and, you know, sub 1 cent per kilowatt hour, you can do electrolysis, which is another way of just saying alchemy, and literally create, you know, synthetic fuels, like, for example, CH4 methane. You could create green hydrogen, which, you know, if you have basically water and air, or you have, you know, carbon dioxide and water, you can put those back together as CH4. You can put them, you know, back together as as green hydrogen. And what's really interesting is a lot of the companies that have done super well in the AI boom, sort of like Bitcoin, that started off with doing Bitcoin, they already had all the interconnects, they already had all the permits, and then all of a sudden they're very prepared for the AI boom. A lot of these companies like Intersect Solar, if you guys saw them, they got acquired by Google a few months back. Pretty major acquisition, multi-billion dollar acquisition. They bet the farm on building these huge solar farms, not for AI in the early 2020s, right around the same time we dropped that paper, but for green hydrogen, because they sort of viewed this as a long duration, sort of easily transportable hydrocarbon alternative. And it turns out all that stuff they did for green hydrogen didn't take off for many reasons. Hydrogen's like a really, you know, reactive element, super hard to work with, super hard to transport compared to something like natural gas. But they spent all this money and time developing, you know, sites and thinking it was going to be green hydrogen as the off-taker. And of course, what ended up happening is that, you know, Google and all of the AI companies ended up buying them out for compute. So anyways, so that's sort of the backstory. In particular, I think there's a short-term and a long-term vision here. In the short term, you know, you've heard that, you know, when Elon stood up Colossus in Memphis and Colossus 2 in Mississippi, you know, he got a lot of flack because he had all of these like diesel generators on site. In addition to the diesel generators, you also need battery packs, like lithium ion battery packs, to be able to balance like real-time sort of demand from the GPUs. But, you know, he got a lot of flack because one, it's super dirty, like when you're burning diesel or, you know, whatever, it's like terrible for the people that live there, you know, horrible for the environment. It's like also super expensive. It's super loud. Like it's part of the reason people hate on data centers. So if you had an alternative where you could sort of have a reliable backup generation source, then all of a sudden you can get, you know, something that's silent, you know, potentially, you know, clean, and delivers that kind of power that a data center needs without all the downsides. And so what Voya is doing, their technology is actually all around metal fuels. And metal fuels, I mean, fascinating idea, is that if you look at, you know, what we call, I guess, sort of electrolytes or metals in the periodic table, it's like all of these elements, which are, you know, extremely, extremely good carriers for energy, extremely, you know, good ways to store energy. And so, you know, when you find, for example, a metal like aluminum, which is what they're using in, naturally in nature, you're finding it as already oxidized, aluminum oxide, or, you know, a compound where the oxygen is already there. What we then do is we have these like smelters, which are extremely expensive energy-wise, and it's often located next to hydro because you have all this sort of free electricity. In fact, this is, I think, in Iceland, they do this with geothermal. You basically see all these places around the world where they use all that to strip the oxygen off and create the actual bare metal. Of course, that bare metal, though, is effectively a battery because it really wants to be able to react again with oxygen. You guys may remember like in high school chemistry class or something that you could like burn magnesium or these little strips of metal, and they're extremely reactive. They burn very quickly. So that's why. They're very hungry to reattach to oxygen atoms or oxygen molecules. And once you use fire to burn them, they can react. So that's what's happening. But if there was a way to use this aluminum as a battery and potentially do it in a way that doesn't require just burning, which is very inefficient, then all of a sudden the aluminum can become a very effective form of a battery, a great effective alternative to the diesel generators, and potentially in the long run, a long duration storage battery, which is what I'm most excited about. And that's what their technology does, is it turns it more into a fuel cell like arrangement, where instead of burning, you know, the metal, you're using an electrochemical process to do the same reactions, but to basically take the free electrons that come off in that reaction and use it as electricity.
Which sources of energy is it compatible with?
Well, it's compatible with anything. I mean, it's effectively just a giant battery, right? So all you need is some way to create the true chemical reaction. So you could do that with, I mean, in this form, you could do it with, you know, sort of combustion and heat, but they've chosen to focus on the electricity route because that's what's most valuable. But you could do this with wind, hydro, solar, nat gas, anything.
Can we get a little bit of a ELI5 explanation of like a specific case here? Like,
yeah.
Steve was asking about like the applications. Can we go deeper into like, is it, you do it with electricity, you sit next to some sort of like an electric generator plant, and then are you using this technology, or they're building like a building next door that's able to take electricity as input and output like some sort of oxidized aluminum, or what's actually happening here?
Yeah. So I'll give a short-term example and then what I'm excited about in the long run. Short-term example is literally think of it as a plug and play replacement for your diesel generator. So in all of these, so think about Colossus, right? So, you know, he's using some electricity from the grid. And then, you know, I'm assuming he's building solar there as well, but whatever, he's got different energy sources in front of the meter and behind the meter. And behind the meter, he also has his battery packs, the Tesla mega walls, and then in power walls. And then in addition to that, he's got these diesel generators. Because when you're doing, in that case, that's for training, you really can't have any downtime whatsoever. So that's why he has, you know, both the generators and the batteries to make up sure there's whatever, as close as possible to 100% uptime. I mean, for inference, obviously that's better as well, but for training, it's essential. And so in this case, you would just take out the generator, you know, the diesel generator, instead put in one of Voya's sort of, this is the proprietary piece, is their proprietary, you know, call it electrochemical reactor or electrolysis machine, whatever you want to call it, where you take in, you know, aluminum-based fuels. And, you know, there's some of a proprietary mix. I think it's not just raw aluminum, but that's the core of the idea. And then from there, you run this electrochemical reaction where the aluminum is able to fuse with oxygen, which is what it wants to do. And in the process, electrons are let off. Those electrons conduct a current. That current can then be used to power anything. So in this case, it would go straight to the GPUs. Now, that's what's happening short term. Where I'm so excited is the long-term vision of this, which is, as you guys know, I'm a solar maximalist, no secret there. And the only issue with solar, of course, as we've talked about many times in the shows, we talked about the Type 1 Summit, is the long duration storage and also the ability to sort of transport that long duration storage. So if you have a lot of solar and batteries, lithium ion batteries, which are what have been coming down the cost curve, that's awesome for your day-to-day adjustments, right? So for things like, you know, oh, it's cloudy for 4 hours, 8 hours. Cool. Not a problem. That's where the batteries are great. But where it is a problem is if you have that for a season, let's say you're in the Pacific Northwest or Britain or somewhere and it gets super cloudy for like 2 weeks at a time, 3 weeks at a time, lithium ion batteries are very unlikely to ever solve that problem, which means you still need to be grid tied and doing some of these kind of loftier ambitions, like I've been talking about, like building new grids or off grid data centers that then turn into new grids are effectively impossible. But with a technology like this, you could overbuild solar and then, or really you could do it anywhere. You could either do it on site and have all of the aluminum pellets basically charged. You take the aluminum oxide that comes off as the waste product and effectively re-separate them again. So you can basically, you know, put them together, re-separate the oxygen, and that creates effectively a battery.
And you mostly want to keep this on site where the...
Not necessarily.
Or you can transport those pellets and they're fairly stable? Or
that's the big vision, is it's just aluminum. Effectively, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a little bit more to it than that, but like to make it simple, it's just aluminum. So yes, you could do it on site and charge the batteries there, charge the aluminum there, or you could just transport it anywhere you can transport aluminum, which means trucks, trains, ships. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, it's very early, but in my opinion, if this ends up working, I mean, this could be one of the most transformative technologies in the entire world. It could totally rewrite where energy gets built and basically allow us to eventually get to the, you know, the blessed five nines with only solar in the desert.
Wow.
Very, very cool.
So
thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was good. Sharing.
Hopefully people like, I mean, I like learning about that. So yeah. Good stuff.
It's all energy, Bitcoin, data centers, everything's energy.
Absolutely.
Everything
speaking of energy and computer. Should we talk about NVIDIA made some big moves this week, including their stock pumped like 10%, which is truly astonishing.
Is that on the news of these?
They're trying to keep up with their strategy.
They had earnings report.
Okay. That too.
Their market cap increased in one day 10 MicroStrategy.
Wow.
I was talking percentage wise. Got a ways to go.
They were $5 trillion. They popped 10%. So half a trillion was their one day gain, which is like 10 Coinbases, 10 blocks, 10 strategies.
Yeah. Right. Half a trillion.
It's mind blowing.
No big deal.
Anyway, but yeah, I think.
On the balance sheet though, right?
NVIDIA? Not yet. Or maybe they self custody and they hide some of their riches off the book. Who knows? No, I think what we are excited to talk about is some of their M&A activity this week.
Yeah,
they did some kind of deal with Poolside, like $6 billion. It was one, I don't know the exact details, but it wasn't like a normal traditional acquisition. I think they acquired the technology or a license to the technology and some of the employees moved over or something like that. But it, I don't know if it was officially stated, but certainly strongly suggested just further beefing up their open model R&D and development. And then the even bigger news, they bought Hugging Face for almost $13 billion, $12.9 billion.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And so, you know, which begged a lot of questions about that valuation and how do you arrive at that or whatever. But, you know, it's kind of like the GitHub acquisition of today. And in a world of AI and lots of investment, like the numbers are bigger, much bigger now. So, and then I don't know how much truth this there is, but probably truth to it. Like OpenAI and others might have been in the bidding war as well. And OpenAI now has hardware that's they're claiming is fast. You know, so they're competing directly with Nvidia. So I think the Hugging Face acquisition makes a lot of sense. And yeah, they're producing and they're selling robots now.
For me, it's one of What's those ones that they got away. Do you know, actually, so it's, I was going to say, because it's now reinvented as a consumer company with a duck. Do you know when Hugging Face started, what it was?
It was like a chat app.
Chat app.
Yeah, it was a Hugging Face icon on an iOS app, and that was your virtual companion. It was basically like a character AI type thing with the Hugging Face was your friend.
And I have to say, I mean, it's extremely impressive. I mean, it's always impressive when an entrepreneur figures out what's coming next and builds a company around that. In my opinion, it's even more impressive, this story, because that was a total pivot. And it's extreme. I mean, they were on the money, like realizing, nah, the future is in, you know, being the GitHub for open source or whatever. Like,
and I think it was Bert that actually was the big takeoff for them, right?
Bert?
I think Bert, the Bert model. Like,
oh, yeah.
Going back, yeah. I think that was a while ago. Yeah. But I think that was what really solidified their early win as a you know GitHub like you know if you want to call it enterprise or kind of a hub for models. I think they were the place everybody went to go find Bert.
Yeah.
The question I'm dying to know the answer to is how much did Kevin Durant influence this pivot and strategy as an early investor?
I'm going to go with not at all.
Wait, does DK know who Kevin Durant is? Have you heard of Kevin Durant?
Basketball player, right?
All right. Good. Wow. Got the right sport. Where did he play Where did he play undergrad?
I'm just gonna guess. Oh, I was gonna say Warriors. I don't know.
Hook 'em horns, I believe, is what you're looking for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which well, anyways, crazy, yeah.
But he had a very good outcome. Financial outcome.
So was he he was one of the early investors in Hugging Face? Was that
seed and Series A round?
Was he also involved in Cursor or somebody else was? I thought I saw a basketball player.
It's the first
player.
Investment I've heard of
who was involved in Cursor.
Being involved in.
Yeah. Good win.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm curious. What's y'all's take on this sort of strategically, financially? Like, yeah. Why do you think they did this? NVIDIA.
Well, I mean, I guess it's like it's an obvious, in a sense, hub to overuse the word, but I think whenever you have these, you know, centralizing forces that help people use tools better, those attract a lot of attention. It becomes kind of like a marketplace, right? So kind of similar to OpenRouter. OpenRouter is like, yeah, you could go sign up for 1,000 different keys with a bunch of different providers, but then they just abstract that, take it up a level and say, hey, we just like aggregate all of those. You don't have to worry about it. It gets out of your way. And I think similarly, like, you can just install the Hugging Face library once, and then you can sort of have it manage and orchestrate all your models and make that whole process simple. So I think that pattern probably will continue to play out again and again, but it seems like a natural fit in that pattern. They got real breakout where they were like the hub where everybody uses it. So it seems natural that would be a strategic asset to almost anybody who cares about AI.
And do you think there's like, because my understanding is their monetization so far was pretty slim. Do you think there's like a sort of natural way, like a way to monetize that independently? Or do you think the only sort of real value accrues if you can point them towards something else? Like, for example, if, you know, I don't know, OpenAI had it, they could point them more towards OpenAI models. Or in the case of NVIDIA, I mean, they obviously have a strategic interest long-term in keeping open source as competitive as possible so that everyone's buying their chips?
I think it's more of the latter. I think if you, in a situation like this, if you put your finger on the scale too much and you direct people toward something that's not the thing they're looking for, not the best solution to their problem, you can do that for a little while. But I think over time, that probably is not sustainable. Whereas saying, like, instead of trying to push people towards something they don't necessarily want, if you try to understand what people do want, yeah, and use that proprietary information that you might be able to develop by running the service to help make maybe open source stuff more competitive, that kind of thing seems pretty reasonable to me. So maybe you notice that, oh, there's this new, you know, closed source model that's getting a lot of attention. Let's figure out how to make sure that the open source ones can be at parity and get at least as much attention, because they actually, they need to get at parity or better, though, or different sets of trade-offs. But trying to just understand the ecosystem, be an important player with a lot of visibility, I think helps.
Yeah.
Helps sell more chips, right?
I mean, exactly. I mean, I think honestly, you know, I know that the early users of products are always disappointed when, you know, the companies quote unquote sell out. But if they had to sell out, NVIDIA seems like by far the best purchaser, because they have every incentive in the world to make sure the open source thrives. Whereas if this had gone to like OpenAI, it would have kind of been like the, you know, the open cloud thing where it's like, that's over.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. I feel like NVIDIA has such, it's hard to not be bullish on NVIDIA's position, but they have a lot to do, you know, to sort of remake the way AI works. It's not just, oh, sell a bunch of chips and everything is as is. It's more like they can really push the open narrative because it actually benefits them. They can actually make it better for everybody to be more open, and they can push the whole world toward more open models, which I think ultimately decentralizes intelligence, makes it available to everybody for cheaper prices, et cetera.
Yeah,
it makes them a very natural ally with most companies and entities in the world too.
Yep.
If you're not, you know, one of the top three or four AI companies in the world, you're pretty much going to be aligned with NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. I mean, what do you think about that sort of like longer or medium term? You know, obviously these guys are going to start going after each other, right? Like they've been kind of friends up until now, but to your point, OpenAI has Jalapeno now, Anthropic's working on their own chips. Obviously Google has the TPU. Do you think that some of these companies particularly, I mean, I think there's two questions here. One, do you think they'll be able to sort of catch NVIDIA and break some of their network effects and moats around things like CUDA and the NVLink and, you know, linkages between the chips? And the sort of subtext of that question is, because their intelligence gets so much further ahead, or do you think on the other hand, NVIDIA has such a strong sort of head start and moat with their chips that with moves like this, they actually will be able to push the open source to make sure that the frontier doesn't run away and get so much better that you know, their lunch gets eaten as well?
Good questions. I mean, competition's great, right? So yeah. It's scary if AI becomes very centralized. We're at least blessed with many very, very strong competitors.
Yep.
Anthropic, OpenAI, Google, Elon, NVIDIA, and more. Well, you know,
China,
SpaceX, AI.
A bunch of companies, a country, a dude, like, you know.
You know, I think it's, I am happy that the other companies are producing chips and competing with NVIDIA. Even though it's easy to ally with NVIDIA, I still wouldn't, you know, we don't want any one company to run away with things. So I think that competition is great. You know, my understanding is like Elon and co are very deeply invested and committed to NVIDIA. So I think that's interesting. That he's decided to sort of go all in on NVIDIA versus...
Why do you think that is? What's sort of driving that?
I don't know. I mean, it could just be like, got a great deal, right? Like he put on the table, like, I'm going to go all in with you, but I want a steep discount because we're going to do a lot of volume.
So I have a big question on that. I mean, I think that's definitely the case. In the last earnings call, obviously Elon revealed their quote exclusive with NVIDIA. Obviously they're getting a better deal with volume. Obviously Jensen loves Elon because he said over and over again, this dude, and I think one, they just like also respect each other, but two, you know, I can stand up basically power faster than anyone else to get my chips actually used. So like there's all kinds of alliance there. On the other hand, I mean, why is no one calling out where Elon says I'm exclusive to NVIDIA And in the same breath, he's like, oh, by the way, I'm building Terrafab to build my own chips. Like, he's definitely not, he's saying he's exclusive, and maybe he's exclusive for now, but like if Terrafab, as soon as Terrafab gets
everything,
out, like
everything's for now. I
mean, everything's for now.
Especially when you, especially when it comes to the big players.
Of course, yeah. but it's just funny to me that it's like, I like it's not even
gets,
a secret.
He gets the pass.
Yeah, he gets the pass. He's literally said, I'm building a new TSMC competitor, which is actually going to not only eat your lunch, but eat the lunch below you as well. Like,
by the way, did he make the Time Magazine top 100 people in AI?
Nah, only Paris.
I mean, and we know Jensen was left out, but was Elon left out?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Yeah,
all right.
I didn't read it.
If there's anyone in the chat that knows this important information, yeah, please let us. The Forbes 100 under 100. That's what I heard they're launching next.
You going to be on that one, Max?
I hope not. I'm not trying to go to prison.
Cool. Anything else with NVIDIA? I think, DK, you wanted to share. You've been plugging away at Grokbot. Did you want to share some of your experiences?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I've been trying to do for a long time, and I think this relates to a lot of, you know, there's sort of like a learning curve where you just keep upskilling and you get better as you push your skills and try to learn something new. And one of the things that I've had a tough time really getting into my workflow is kind of, you know, really long horizon tasks. So things that are like, hey, I want you to go off and do a bunch of research on this topic, you know, for, you know, 12 hours or a day or two. And I think this is like, if you can figure out how to incorporate this, it's actually really helpful to any kind of research or development process. But figuring out what's the right tool and what's the right task to put them on and stuff is pretty tough. So I started playing with the slash goal feature of Codex about a week or so ago, maybe. And I know it's been out for a while, but I just never had gotten around to finding a thing. And what I found is I actually use the interactive chat style to help me design a goal. So the interactive chat already knew what I was trying to do, because I'd been chatting with it for a while. And I said, hey, can we plan some long-range goals on this? So I, you know, help me create a goal prompt. So I started doing that. And that turned out to be really effective and made a lot of progress at stuff that I'd kind of been stuck on. Because I have like a habit where I'll often go, I'll be building something and I, it'll be like, you know, time to go to bed. And I'll be like, okay, work autonomously for the next 6 hours or 12 hours. Just make a ton of progress on this. But when you're in interactive mode and it doesn't exactly know, it usually comes back and it can't do more than about half hour, an hour worth of work. So with slash goal, it can do a lot more. Now, I just about a day ago got Grokbot, which is really useful because it actually has that connection to Twitter. So if you're doing research on a new topic or a new area you want to learn about, it actually can read Twitter for you every day. As kind of a long range, right? So you don't have to go to Twitter. You can actually just set up Grokbot, and you can have it do a bunch of research. So a topic I'm doing research on right now is there's tons of different video models. Everybody's talking about the new Seedance stuff, the new OmniFlash from Gemini, lots of cool new demos, you know. And then there's a bunch of tools that people use to get the best out of these. You know, some people talk about Higgsfield and Runway ML and Utopai, U-T-O-P-A-I. I think it's Utopai or something. But all these tools.
Utopia?
Maybe that's how they say it. it's Utope AI.
So it could be. Coming in with that hard hitting.
It's probably right. But like, which models should you use for what tasks, and how do you actually structure stories with these models? So I actually sent Grokbot off on a bunch of work to go look at certain creators who I've seen who do a good job at this. And I've told it to watch their tweets and evaluate across all these tools and then generate for me kind of a daily summary of everything going on in sort of the video creation with kind of my own prompting and tooling layered in there. And that has been I'm just about a day in, but it looks very promising that I think I'm going to get a lot of good research output from that. So I would encourage you to try Grokbot and come up with your own things that you just either want to like stay informed on or something that you think is happening, but you don't feel like you've had enough time to fully digest or research it to the extent that you want. And then try giving a task like that to a Grok bot and see if you can actually, you know, get a daily update and if that helps your sort of learning process.
Good stuff. Couple questions. One, are you using it within Buzz or standalone?
I haven't used it within Buzz yet. Does Grokbot support ACP kind of natively?
I know someone who got it working. So either someone else has a shim or I would guess that. But the same, okay. It's the same with Claude Code and Codex. Like ACP, so ACP itself is providing that shim.
But in the case of like Codex or Claude, I think they actually natively support ACP, right? Or the CLI does or something. They don't?
No.
Okay.
You have to download it from the ACP website.
Oh, okay. So when I haven't downloaded it, but I've used them. So how did that work?
What do you mean?
I haven't downloaded
them?
I downloaded Buzz and I've downloaded Claude Code and Codex, but haven't done
Buzz automates it for you.
Oh, okay.
When we were using Buzz in April or whatever, it didn't automatically do it. We installed it separately.
Oh, okay.
I think we sent you the command and you just blindly ran it on your computer.
Sounds right. Yeah.
I also increased my Bitcoin wallet. I do know someone who's used it within Buzz, so that might be interesting. Second question.
Does Guz generally support a lot of like these long horizon goal oriented type things? Is that kind of native?
You could do anything in there, no?
Yeah, I mean it should work over ACP.
Okay. I haven't tried this goal stuff I just got into recently and haven't tried it under ACP yet.
Well, I mean, I'm curious what you mean by goal. What is this slash goal? I haven't used this.
Okay, so slash goal is, you know, at least on Codex and Claude, it's a type of command. You type slash goal, and then you write out something that has some sort of a deterministic exit characteristic. Like, let's say you say, I want to do everything required, to get this app submitted to the App Store. And so you've got the whole spec already written. And then you can write slash goal, follow this spec and keep making your own decisions and then make sure that, don't stop until you have this thing submitted to the App Store. Yeah. And it'll just go ahead and keep making progress on that. It'll write tests and do whatever you've agreed to in the spec or sort of written down the spec. But it'll write all of that and then it'll actually get it to the App Store. So it's just sort of autonomously keeps running and chugging away at something. It's when you think about most of your usage of like a, most of your use is like an interactive chat format.
Yeah.
Right? So like Buzz feels like interactive chat.
Right.
And you say something, you get a response. Say something, you get a response, right? Whether it's a human or an agent, coordinates all that in a chat session. The goal stuff is more like a background, almost like a cron job or a background running task that kind of keeps going, wakes up if something goes wrong.
And is the key, though, you're basically handing it the key saying, make your own decisions?
Well, it's that's certainly part of it is make recommendations, but it's assuming that you're not intending to be interactive.
Right.
Right. So the default of almost any LLM you've used, the default is it assumes you're trying to be interactive. You say something, it says something. You say something, it says something.
Right.
But if you can spec something out that's a bigger chunk and you don't actually want to be involved in the back and forth, you can spend some time up front, do the spec, and then say slash goal. Let's get this thing done. And it will just keep iterating on that until it's basically done or stuck or something.
So one thing that jumped out to me immediately where something like Buzz would be very useful is, I mean, the value of Buzz, as I see it, is multiplayer mode. All these other things are great at single player mode. And so one thing that could be really interesting is you might have a fleet of agents that know you very well for different things. Maybe you're like business agent or your personal agent or whatever. You may also have agents of people that you trust or people that you trust even, right? And I almost think about this a little bit in that, what's that sort of, that voting scheme where you can like choose on different topics to whom you wish to delegate your vote. For example, instead of just like, oh, I vote one, you know, for one person, it's like, well, on all subjects around energy policy, like I want Mez to make that vote for me. On all subjects of AI policy, I'm going to give that to DK. And all
it's like ranked order voting or?
No, it's not ranked order. It's like a delegation system, but you can delegate on different
on a per topic basis.
Yeah, which actually makes a ton of sense. And by the way, I think that's one area that we still haven't seen is like democracy and like voting should be totally rewritten in the next couple of years. But imagine if you're doing this sort of slash goal thing, you might say, okay, you know, I want to build whatever this app and I want to integrate payments in there. It's like, listen, slash goal, and it either automatically learns this or you give it some sort of like helpful guidelines where it's like, when you're defaulting to anything to do with Bitcoin payments, I want you to check with Steve and his fleet. Mm. And if either Steve or his fleet are in the chat, like those are the guys you go with. If you don't know what to do, like ask what would Steve's bots do and literally talk to them.
Right.
Or if you have an Iowa State sports question.
I guess you to get the most
out of Iowa State beat Memphis? Absolutely not. Then you can ask me.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. I think to get the most out of Steve's bots in that case, you'd need more than just like maybe a persona prompt, but you'd actually want to see how Steve solved similar problems.
Sure.
Right. So you sort of need to get agreement from Steve that the bots are allowed to share full context of all the channels or some sort of distilled knowledge that was aggregated from the way that Steve was using the bots, right?
Well, and that's really nice because the per channel feature, right? You could literally just be like, for each channel, like, what do you green light or not?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess the more stuff that just happens in public, the better, because then you don't have a lot of like nasty permission switches and stuff you have to think about and do. But
there's going to be, I mean, yeah, the more in public, obviously, there's a lot to learn from, but there's always going to be cases where it's like, I don't know, like, I don't want like to expose myself to all of these attack services by letting the world talk to me, but if like Steve and DK's bots want to ask my bot a question, totally fine.
Right.
And you could even imagine that as a business, right? Like as we think about the pay channels, it's like, okay, I need to like troubleshoot this kind of app. I know that like it's a security app or whatever. And like Jesse's been thinking a lot about this. So it's like, you know, Jesse will let me in his channel and access all of his data and all of his bots for a fee.
What one thing to be careful with is even though we trust each other, you know, what if I'm not as responsible with my OPSEC, especially in a whole new foreign territory of AI development, and my agent gets like prompt inject attacked, mm-hmm. and then now your agent's trusting my agent,
yeah,
but mine's been infected. It would be kind of like my protection for my for malware in my laptop. Let's say I'm like top notch. But I've also introduced this trust and dependency on your guys' laptop malware management, right? Yeah. And then you make a mistake, you get phished or whatever. You're trying to get a job for a shitcoin in North Korea, like in the interview process. No, this is real. You apply for a job, and then like for some cryptocurrency. And then the attackers have you install software in your computer to conduct the interview, and then they compromise your computer. Wow. Another attack, and someone I know and work with just had this almost impact him. He was asked to do like a CoinDesk or some kind of like podcast. And he's like, oh, okay. And then they're like, just install this podcast software. And it turns out it was a scam. They're going to compromise the computer. So anyway, but the point about trusting our agents, I think it does extend the security service. So even if you trust your friend or trust a person, you know, you are exposing yourself more.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that I know you guys are just like YOLOing with Cloud Code and computer ain't no chance. I'm talking to y'all. But I actually do think, I mean, obviously those are all things that need to get solved, right? And like the only way to like really, I'm sure we'll talk about this more with like the hacking stuff that's been happening recently, but like the only way to vet other people's agents is with agents, right? So like there's got to be some new standard for how you judge that. I do think though, it's important. I want to re-highlight, even though I haven't really played with Grokbot yet, my understanding is one of the key features is you run these agents at their computers on a Linux virtual machine in the cloud.
Yeah, it's a cloud, yeah.
Right. And so that is precisely the experience, you know, that I've been asking for in Buzz and everywhere else. Is like to me that that is the answer. It's like, for most people, like, unless you really know what you're doing, and even then, probably shouldn't be running anything on your computer. So I think that that sort of like, I don't know, workflow in the future is just like push as much as possible off to someone else's virtual machine, or like just-in-time virtual machine. Makes way more sense to me.
Yeah, it almost seems like we need to get more comfortable with something iPad-like as our only real client, and everything else needs to be kind of a virtual machine in a cloud somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, computers are done. Computers are cooked.
But because, like, I know, Steve, have you changed your posture with respect to downloading client software? I forget if we talked about this, but...
You mean overall?
Yeah,
overall. I mean, I changed like 10 years ago or whatever. My OPSEC previously was horrible. And then I got into Bitcoin, and then I'm like, oh, I'm like a disaster.
Then you cleaned it up. Okay.
And then I cleaned it up, and then I've had good OPSEC hygiene since then, including being very selective on installing software on my laptop, although a little bit more YOLO recently with...
This is what I'm getting at.
Podcode and Buzz.
I think I sort of followed your trajectory, but I've gotten much more YOLO in the past years because I'm just like, there's too much stuff happening.
But so, which is always the, you know, I think being extreme either way is bad. I mean, if you're just like ambivalent or like just, you don't even like know what you're doing, then you're just like reckless and a disaster waiting to happen. But the other extreme, someone who would pride themselves in being like extremely security conscious, I mean, I respect that greatly. But if you are literally not adopting new technology or exploring because of such a hardline stance, that has costs. That, I mean, there are costs to that. So there's trade-offs. So, but I do think like we'd be smart to, learn more about, sandboxing and running VMs and stuff like that on our own computers. Also, I mean, I totally agree with Max, like that the way things are headed is hosted agents as well. I mean, a combination, but that's I think an essential part of this as well.
Yeah. I've thought about, I haven't yet gotten a special Mac device just always running for that, but I could imagine.
Because you can't. Because that's how crazy the market is right now.
Oh.
Like, seriously, no. Like, after you guys gave me a hard time the first time with the Buzz stuff, and I was like, all right, I'm going to go buy this Mac Mini. They were sold out for like weeks or months, and like months if you want like any decent amount of RAM.
They just introduced new products.
Yeah, did you place your order for the $18,000?
Yeah, I was going to say, you can get the Mac Studio 500.
Still in a bear market, TK. tell me when ATH.
I've got the hack for you. I've got the hack. Go to your community college and sign up as a student for $46. You can sign up and be a student at your community college, and then you qualify for the academic discount. So it's only $16,000 we're talking here. Come on.
That's actually, that's a worthwhile hack. Where did you get that idea?
I don't know. This is the alpha you get listening to PBJ.
You know, that's actually kind of brilliant. Where did you get that idea? Because you could probably also get all kinds of other discounts, like gyms and movie theaters. And, yeah, that's nice.
There you go. A little pay for itself when you get that.
I'm a student of life, baby.
Getting back to, I said I had two questions for on the ground. Yeah. So the question is for both of you guys. But I think you saying that the exclusive access to Twitter content was pretty compelling. That actually makes that encourages me to go use Grokbot. The way you used it, that makes a lot of sense to me. So that's pretty cool. So then it begs the question, was, you know, Twitter worth $42 billion or whatever it was paid? Because I get at the time, I mean, within like a few months, I think like a month or two after the deal was signed, the stock market crashed. And then all of a sudden Twitter was like in theory worth $14 billion or something. So and then Elon tried to get out of the deal and tried to reduce the price. And there's all that drama that year.
Right.
And, you know, most people at the time thought it was wildly overvalued. But now compare it, Elon just paid $60 billion for Cursor, right? And a lot of that was data. So to me, my instinct is $42 billion for Twitter is a steal compared to $60 billion for Cursor.
I mean, as a user, I like the thing that I'm able to do with it. But I just think the Cursor data set is just wildly more valuable than the Twitter data set. Like it's not data is not just data is it's not all interchangeable. Like you have end to end feedback on coding tasks that is like a gold mine.
Yeah. But I'll challenge that a little bit. I'll challenge that. So I feel like it's a lot easier for others to reproduce the coding data because there's not the network effects. Whereas with Twitter, it's very hard to reproduce another Twitter. So all their competitors, it's quite credible that they're going to get similar level of cursor data just by providing developer tools that are collecting.
Yeah, I could hear that. I also don't think that I think Twitter is nice to get information. That's what I currently use. I can't, if you sort of fast forward the world 10 years, I think all of these public feeds are going to be so overrun by AI content creation that they kind of could all similarly look kind of the same or have, you know, mostly be stuff that we train ourselves not to pay attention to. I mean, already I find it hard to just browse and get good stuff. I really have to go like looking for the kinds of stuff I want. And if that's the case, if you're reading a tweet versus reading Twitter, that's a very different thing, even though they sound very similar. And so, you know, if I know, oh, there's a topic I want, there's a skill I'm trying to learn, there's a type of research I'm trying to do, go out and find that. You know, it's on Twitter today, but I don't know that it's necessarily uniquely on Twitter forever. Like it could, and actually some of the stuff that I find, it's actually on Twitter, but then it's actually like, actually I found, you know, I'm just thinking about yesterday, there was a video production workflow that I was interested in. It was a video hosted on Twitter, but it was also cross-posted on YouTube. I went to YouTube, downloaded, got the transcript and ingested the transcript into an LLM. And so at that point, like, I don't know, what of it is Twitter data? I'm just not. To me, I think the idea of like what does a feed look like in the future and how proprietary and unique and network affected are those, I'm not super bullish that those the feeds that we have today are super defensible long term.
Yeah, I see honestly both as really good deals and for different reasons. For me, honestly, I think the cursor acquisition is going to go down as probably the best acquisition in history. And probably wildly undervalued, because I think the big lesson of the last 3 years has been coding is all that matters. Like that's the only thing that matters. Like the, you know, you look at OpenAI betting on doing consumer stuff and they were doing video stuff and Google was doing video stuff and whatever, where Anthropic, the way that they were able to come and burst into the first place, yep, despite being, you know, it's easy to remember this now, right? But, you know, and first of all, just as a zoom out to your point, Steve, like numbers are so much bigger now. Timelines are so compressed now. It's like, I don't think, I mean, it's so weird to watch the world kind of like splitting apart, because, you know, it's like even in San Francisco, especially now, you know, I'm traveling this week, like other parts of like the world have no idea. People are still barely even adopting any AI at all. Meanwhile, even in San Francisco, there was like, you know, I think that tweet, which is kind of true, which is like, man, you know, people are joking, like, is he old money like SaaS or like, mm-hmm, you know, new money AI? And the new money and the new sort of AI thing is just so much bigger than anyone dreamed. And like the old heads, I learned that term recently, unks, I heard DK using this term. The unks are so far behind in understanding what's happening. It's all these like 22-year-olds that understand what's going on with AI. It's like an order, if not two orders of magnitude bigger economy already, and it's accelerating, mm-hmm, right? And so the big takeaway from Anthropic is just, if you believe in recursive self-improvement, it's 100% focused on coding. So the only data that matters is coding. And I mean, I'm saying that loosely. I'm sure some of this stuff matters a little bit, but like it's basically just coding. And so the reason, you know, if you remember, I think when it was like Opus 3.6 dropped and like Replit was kind of starting to use it in there a little bit, OpenAI was still dominant and all of the quote unquote smart money was betting big on OpenAI only. And it was only like some like weirdos. Like if you look at the cap table for Anthropic, it was not tier one funds. It was a bunch of like weird effective altruists that got in early. And, you know, it was like some okay funds, but like, you know, the big funds, the, you know, whatever, the tier ones were betting on OpenAI. And then, you know, people—
And it was like, an EA and a safety pitch. It wasn't—
Totally.
Pitch.
Totally. And we've talked about this before. I mean, I remember seeing that, like the greatest regret probably my entire life. And I was like, well, I don't want this whole safety thing. And man, was I wrong on that? But, or maybe I was right, but you know, financially wrong. But and I remember at that time when everyone was like, okay, OpenAI has already won. Or, you know, maybe Google still has a chance, but like they've already got all the consumer network effects. And you know, everyone was like, you know, but Claude's this cute thing. It's really good at coding. So if you're doing coding, it's good at that. Fast forward 1 year, they're dominating because they have all of the coding data. Everyone that's coding is with that. The engineers were all using that. And then, you know, that network effect compounded. OpenAI kills its video model. It moves into coding. So, you know, and I have to give mad props to Elon here, because at that point, you know, Grok could have and probably should have just died. But, you know, he realized the only way to catch back up in this battle is to get the coding data on par with Anthropic. And the only two companies that maybe could have done that, maybe outside of the, you know, like Google or whatever, the big companies, and even then they don't have as much, would have been Cursor, number one, or maybe like Devin, the Cognition, maybe. And apparently he tried to buy both. So super, super smart what he was doing, trying to get those data sets. And I have to think the only reason the Cursor people went along with it, even though $60 billion is obviously, you know, it's no, I mean, in today's market, you know, maybe one day that'll look back as chump change, is that they weren't in a position to utilize their data to catch Anthropic without the compute. It was like they had to find a compute partner.
That's the 1 + 1 = 3. And
exactly.
Grok similarly had all this compute and didn't have anything to spend it on.
Exactly.
So like nobody was using, like there's not enough super Grok usage on Twitter compared to coding. I still don't think people really have digested the fact that, like, if you've used an LLM, you're like, oh, I went to ChatGPT and I typed something, it gave me a response back. The response was amazing. That's amazing. That's an amazing new product. It's like, sure, but that almost is irrelevant for token generation, token usage.
Yeah.
Creating software is kind of going to be all of token usage. Like, information is probably the, you know, fundamental organizing principle of the universe. Like, at its really base layer, it's just information.
Just information.
And coding is just organizing that information in different ways, right? Like pulling information out, shuttling it somewhere else.
Yep.
And so the idea that, like, oh, there's this some subset of LLMs that you choose to use in an interactive mode is fine. We get that. That's how we use, but it's basically irrelevant for token sales. Token sales is information organization and manipulation.
And that's why, I mean, people haven't fully grokked the fact that Anthropic is, you know, about to do $100 billion a year. And I'm assuming almost none of that is the consumer part. It's all enterprises doing coding. And so anyways, all of that to say, I think Elon continues to be the GOAT. He realized he lost, and somehow, just like every time people count him out, figures out the one thing that'll get him back in the race, does it, executes on the deal, and buys the most valuable data set that it gives him a shot to compete with Anthropic. So amazing. Having said all that, even though I think Cursor is way more valuable than Twitter for that data, I still think Twitter is extremely valuable. I mean, the data is not nothing, right? Like, it is proprietary data. It's still, you know, a valuable market. But I think what he did there, which was amazing, is just the user base. When you have the entire world, you know, all using your product, then, you know, it's kind of like Google. Now he can ship out whatever he builds with his intelligence next to, you know, at least all the tech neurotic or whatever. You know,
yeah, I think I would stop short of the entire world. I think Instagram is the entire world. TikTok is the entire world. Twitter is this tiny sliver of like your world.
Yeah, but like, I'm off Twitter right now, actually, and it's much better life. Let me rephrase that. As a percentage of GDP, they're the Apple of whatever distribution, in the sense of like the people that, all of the people that are making decisions are on Twitter.
It's the dominant like text social media.
Tech social media, and critically, not just tech social media, but it's like Instagram is like everyone, but let's say the average whatever GDP per user on Twitter is like probably three orders of magnitude higher. I don't know. Maybe that's excessive.
Also, another interesting metric could be sort of like the quality of the content in terms of from a vantage point of ingestion into and building a model. And it wouldn't surprise me if Twitter was much higher quality on that metric.
Depends on what you're doing. Seeddance is a frontier video model now. They wouldn't exist without all the TikTok video data.
Yeah, well,
you'll
never catch me there.
Yeah.
Anyhow, looking at the time, we wanted to talk about AI security stuff too, because there's a number of different things that popped up this week. I read one report on Twitter from a guy who, I think he claimed to be like the lead investigator, one of the investigators of the Hugging Face OpenAI incident. And that was, I don't know if you read that, but it was just, it's a pretty scary account. You know, he went in, sort of tried to look at all the forensic evidence, and the amount of data generated by all of the agent swarms, I forget how many agents there were, but there are a lot of agents, a lot of content produced, because this lasted for an extensive period of time. So even with agents to look at all that data, it was almost too much data. So that presented a huge obstacle. And it really was difficult to track down exactly what happened. He was claiming like the final day they had, because I think he went, are you still there, Max?
Says he's here with audio only.
Oh, might be a bio break. I think he was like on premises. So he only had so much time. Like he was there for, I don't know, 3 days or something like that. And a lot of the revelations came like right at the last minute as well. And I think they did piece it together pretty well in the end. But then his post also highlighted a number of things that were in their favor during this investigation, and we can't count on those in the future. And that includes just, you know, obviously like AI and agents getting even smarter and coordinating better and creating even more volume of data, et cetera. But also the agent you're using to investigate, are they going to be on your side?
Right.
and a bunch of other reasons. So that was just like a sobering account of things. So that was one thing. Let's see, what else? Sam Altman tweeted something that honestly seemed kind of pointless to me. Meaning like he's like, you know, now is a important, I'm paraphrasing, but like now is a very important window of time, moment in time where cybersecurity threats are very, very high and we need to be on it for defenses. But it's like, okay, anyone paying attention or responsible for software systems already knows that or should know that. And B, he can take actions at OpenAI to help and not like neuter their models to allow people to defend their system with their models. So yeah, I didn't really get much out of that tweet. Then the other event, CLN, which is it stands for Core Lightning. It's an implementation of the Lightning Network. It had kind of a difficult past few days, in that they had to do over again. They would rethink how this was announced, but they've found some vulnerabilities in their software. So they're fixing them. They just produced a new release and published it today. But I think it, zooming out, reevaluating responsible disclosures and the release process for software when you're fixing security vulnerabilities, that needs to be completely reevaluated to see what still makes sense and what might need to be revised. And then part of that too is like reproducible builds, and we can get, because I'm seeing that challenge now by some folks. So I'm interested in talking about those two topics, but let's first start it with a concrete story. I think this is not specific to CLN. We're going to use it as an example because it's the topic of the week. But every software system has vulnerabilities. It can, and that's being discovered in real time very quickly by AI. But
these new ones discovered because it was the first time it got access through like a frontier cybersecurity model?
We don't know.
Well, I do know, but no. I can't.
Steve's got the alpha. Come on.
I can't really. I mean, Project Loop we've talked about, and then there's the Red Team and stuff like that. So there's those types of efforts that are finding vulnerabilities. And a lot of software projects are doing their own internal stuff as well. So,
but a lot of existing software projects haven't had access to the best stuff out there yet, right? So there's kind of going to be a rolling, we'd expect to see rolling over the next 3 to 6 months, things like this happening frequently, right? As these models become available?
Yes. I do think the best cyber versions of the frontier models are meaningfully better but Kimmy K3 is very good at finding vulnerabilities. So it's not like it. It's not like open weight models can't find vulnerabilities. It's very, very good. So software projects today, even if you don't have access to the latest and greatest, you absolutely should be using the best available to you. You will find vulnerabilities. And you know, also sign up for Project Loop and you know,
Steve will look for you.
Potentially, well, I don't do the work, but but there, you know, might neither do
the engineers anymore.
might have more advanced models to help. But in any case, I think several lessons learned here, or at least interesting things to discuss, because the way this was communicated, I think was you know, needed a do-over.
Why?
Well, I didn't see it. So, yeah.
I thought you were always on Stacker News.
I am, and I looked briefly. I mean, I've been traveling this week, so less so. But I looked briefly, and I saw they said something like, "Take your note offline."
Yeah.
But
so well, I mean, I guess one point I was trying to make too. I mean, every software project has vulnerabilities that they're being found very quickly with AI, but the severity level and can vary greatly. So some projects, sure, they have like medium severity vulnerabilities. They'll fix them. Not that big a deal. And it's just a matter of like, they can just put them in a security maintenance release and say, hey, update it. And generally, there's not much risk. If there's critical severity vulnerabilities that could be a loss of funds or something, you know, catastrophic, well, that's very different. And then, like we've talked about cold card, that's the worst possible case, because that there, even a software update doesn't fix it for you. Mm-hmm. That's by far the worst. But yeah, someone posted on Stacker News a Discord message in the CLN Discord, speaking to, which is a public Discord. So it is public. It was public information, but usually these community Discords are, you know, kind of like just the people very close to the project. But you know, the general message there was like, there's
run.
that's the very simple way to say it.
ELFI.
No, that, you know, that there's you know, there's an important update coming. There's vulnerabilities that were discovered that are being fixed. The release will be out in a couple days, like 48 hours. It will be binary only, and not open source. Which that's merits scrutiny, because it's an open source project. It's historically supported reproducible builds. So any good Bitcoiner is adversarial minded, and it should scare you a little bit when a project
set off, like, red flags and alarms and
should
stuff.
Set off red flags that, oh, here's a binary. It's an emergency. Update it. And we're not releasing the code to, you don't even know if the binary you're running now, which is managing your Bitcoin funds, matches the code from the developers that you're trusting.
But you're saying justice, in this case, this was legit, but it just couldn't be provided.
The rationale is, you know, fix the bugs, put the release out, embargo the source code for 2 weeks. So also part of the plan is in 2 weeks after the release, then make the source code available. And the rationale being, give time for people to update their node software before
the bug,
before the bad guys can point their LLMs at the source code.
Right.
So I mean, there's a legitimate rationale behind it. It wasn't like...
But as soon as you say that, the bad guys are already pointing their LLMs at the old source code.
Well, so that's why I think it merits review. Yeah. So first of all, what you just said, Max, you know, if there's an alert out saying like, hey, every bad guy, you don't have to scan all the world's software. This software has Bitcoin behind it and there's severe vulnerabilities, so they can focus their attention on that. They can point at the existing public source code, which presumably has the vulnerabilities, and find it. Two, when the binaries are available, we've talked about this a little bit in the show before, but LLMs can reverse engineer binaries and find vulnerabilities as well. I don't think to the degree that if you have the access to the source code as well, but they absolutely can find vulnerabilities in software from the binaries. So, so it puts into question how much value there really is waiting any period of time to release the open source software. I'm still, there's just a lot of questions about this whole process. So I'm still like gathering opinions and thinking about it myself. But my current thinking and position would be, I think the source code still should go out at the same time as the binary, that the cost in creating that window of time is greater than the benefit. Like the cost being like a breach of trust, setting a bad precedent, getting people comfortable installing binary software without the open source code and without a reproducible build. I think that is a big cost and not worth the cost. Because I think bad actors equipped with AI are likely to find the bugs right away anyway. Another thing I'd say is I think it's dangerous to announce and then not have the binaries available. At least make an announcement basically saying like, if you're saying like use the offline option to CLN, if you're worried, well that screams like there's some serious stuff going on. And if you're gonna make that type of announcement, I currently lean towards you should have the binaries available when you make that announcement. And then the third thing is they announced it in Discord, but not from their official X account or any social media account or their website or like from Lockstream. So that was, and then there's a couple of issues with that. Such a serious announcement, then you're kind of unsure. It's like, well, it's this Discord user posted it and they seem like they're from Lockstream, but are they? And then like why isn't the official account from the project not announcing it? It creates these questions. It also allows others to control the narrative. So like, you know, Callie posted about it, warning people, well-intentioned, I think. And then, his tweet blew up, like a lot of his tweets do. Blew up meaning like, you know, like it got a lot of attention. So you're allowing others to control the narrative. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of lessons learned here. And, but it's not just like pointing fingers at CLN. Every software project needs to reevaluate how they handle this. So we need to be learning from all these experiences that are happening in real time right now. BTC Pay also recently had to deal with this. Obviously, the cold card situation and bolts and like
a lot.
What's happening, by the way? Have we heard any more updates? I haven't heard of cold card in a couple of weeks. Any updates on what's happening with them?
I have not heard of any more thefts. So I think the cost to the attacker exceeds the bounty
for now.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the cost will come down over time, though. I don't know how much they're spending, but I assume as the models get better and better, or maybe the low.
This isn't AI. This is the cost of brute forcing.
Got it.
Cryptography. Yeah. So, yes, it'll come down, but not meaningfully.
Interesting.
Billy says, or bounty go up, but I mean, well, I
yeah,
sure as heck hope exposed cold card customers are not adding funds to that wallet. They should be getting off of that wallet.
Well, bounty go up.
Yeah, number go up could be profitable to get a year from now if the price were double or triple or something.
For people that haven't even read about it yet. So
yeah, that's what's scary there. But anyway. So go ahead, Max.
Well, no, I mean, I think there's a lot to chew on and everything you just laid out. I mean, to me, a few things that jump to mind immediately. Number one, you know, I don't know how much of the Sam Altman thing is posturing, how much of it is new breakthroughs we don't know about, how much of it is just that he's alerting the rest of the world to what the Bitcoin community has been going through for the last, you know, month, 6 weeks, whatever, just because, again, as we said, Bitcoin has value attached. So of course, the Bitcoin software gets attacked before the other sort of software. So my sort of base case is this is like, you know, it's just nothing new because Bitcoin was the first to have to deal with this. And in some ways it sucks in the short run, but in the long run, it's better because it allows us to, you know, harden our systems faster, become more resilient in the long run. So it's probably good. The thing I will say on that though is I do think, and I agree with you, Steve, like obviously you should use whatever models you have access to, you know, the best open source stuff. But I do think it's worth noting that, I mean, who knows from the rumor mill, but you're hearing a lot of people, including Sam Altman, people that were in DC this week, people affiliated with Anthropic, basically saying that like a new level of breakthroughs has been achieved. And I think the one thing that is concerning and for people to keep in the back of their mind, not to freak everyone out too much, but is like, you know, we talk about, oh, open source is catching up and all this, and it's true, but we have no idea what the real frontier is right now. I think that's really important for people to understand. Mm-hmm. Like, right. You know, from everything that I've read, there are at least two generations ahead, at least, for both OpenAI and Anthropic. And OpenAI announced this week, or was announced through the rumor mill, that a new pre-train just finished this week as well. And so if you are really scaling Lost Build, and if you think that, you know, whatever, Mythos 2 is already out. We don't even have Mythos, right? We just have like the super neutered fable for civilians. Then like at the very, you know, sort of top, which would just be these like two companies plus, you know, whatever, the government, the frontier may be way, 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 way better. Now, the good news is those people have very little incentive to just go around hacking open source projects. But I think it's important for people to remember, like, just because we see, you know, the frontier as being just a little bit ahead of the open source, we have no idea what the frontier actually is. So that's one thing. And it does seem like there's a lot of noise and chatter around, you know, something big has just happened. What that is, I mean, I saw someone on this, because I'm not on Twitter, I'm reading Reddit more, the king of the vague post. But I do think it's also interesting this week, that, I think it was this week that Sam declared he thinks OpenAI will have AGI by the end of the year. So the people at the very frontier of intelligence keep speeding up the timelines, not slowing them down. What we do with that information, I don't know, but I do think that's like, it's an important fact for people to understand.
That is here. Max replaced his 10 hours a week on Twitter with 20 hours a week on Reddit and called it a win.
Exactly. It's horrible how that happens.
No, for mental health.
Actually, but for whatever reason, Reddit and Stacker News don't, I don't know, they don't suck nearly as much time for me. Like I like to read Stacker News and I like to check Reddit Singularity and that's about it.
So, I'll tell you though, Max, you should, I would encourage you to try, give Twitter another try with now because... Yeah, you can sort of customize the interface to get this if you want. I sort of went through the same experiment we talked about on the show, I don't know, 6 months or 9 months ago, where I was basically off Twitter and only on Reddit, and actually found that it's harder to get the same quality of new information on Reddit. And so that's part of what like makes it easier to kind of disconnect and put in a box. But I wonder if something around like how Grokbot can do research for you around topics you want, and then it can just present you maybe like a daily digest newsletter, but you can really get the stuff that's like the frontier of what's being said. And, you know, and I also think the algorithms on Twitter have evolved a lot since I had sort of taken a pause and come back. It's a much nicer place, I'd say.
To me, it's not about the algorithms. It's about the infinite scroll. So I actually was listening to you and kind of earmarked that in my mind. Yeah, because like there's no doubt like for like the energy stuff that I'm following, like the best stuff is still dropping on Twitter for sure. I will say most of the good stuff that I need, you know, finds its way in my way. Either you guys texting it to me, Anjali texting it to me, finding it through Reddit. So I would say I'm still getting, you know, 70%.
Weird doom scrolling as a service.
You're my doom scrollers, yeah. or hope scrollers. But this Grokbot research thing, I like, if I could have it as a finite report, I think I would.
It's like a daily newsletter.
Yeah. That's something that I would do. Yeah. So I'm going to do that. One other thing I actually wanted to mention on this as well. So I'm curious your take on that like just no one has any idea like how far ahead like the actual, you know, frontier is. The other thing that I will mention that's a little bit more hopeful is I listened to the Sail Research Guys podcast. This week. It was so excellent. By the way, Solar Maximalist, Solar and Wind.
I was going to hype that too. I loved it.
Excellent podcast. And actually, we should get him either for the open source or the Type 2 Summit. Would be worth
it. He already came to Founders, you should know.
Really? Wonderful. Yeah. Maybe then help me hook it up. Let's get him in. Seriously, though, because he would benefit greatly. The missing ingredient for what he wants is what Type 2 is going to offer, which is basically the super cheap solar clouds with the high uptime or high downtime.
Yeah.
factor. So just to give a TLDR, you know, what he was basically saying is, you know, he wants to build, and this is what I was hoping, and maybe one day something like open agents will head in this direction, but something that I've always wanted is basically for a lot of tasks, to your point with the overnight stuff, you don't need to route it to the absolute, I need it right now.
Yep.
It's like, hey, there's this really cool research project or thing I want to run, but I want it as like, you know, a background task. And if it takes 2 weeks, that's cool. And basically, you know, route cycles or route tokens toward it when it's cost effective to do so. Yeah. So the cloud that he's talking about that he wants to, you know, eventually, so to start with, you sort of aggregate. And so this actually, Steve, this gets to the other block dude. I forgot what he was building, the mesh network, the mesh LLM thing. Like if you have a sort of protocol or standard where anyone with spare GPUs can just point towards this pool with a price. And if you have sort of depreciated, in the same way we talk about like depreciated ASICs, depreciated GPUs, mm-hmm. or like old school GPUs, you know, there's no way that OpenAI or Anthropic are going to bid for that because they need the top of the line. But if you can just point this, it's like, well, otherwise the alternative is, you know, it's just unused. So you point it towards this pool where this like giant backlog of background tasks can tap into it when it's cost effective to do so, like overnight, for example, then that gets very interesting. And what he talked about, you know, eventually what he would like to do is own the clouds themselves, which he talks about if you have, for example, a solar or wind-based cloud where you can, you know, sort of power the chips only when there's cheap enough power. And when it's gone, if it's only, you know, 90% uptime, okay. But it's like way cheaper, right? And so,
it reminded me a lot of, do you know the early Google story? I don't know if you followed the .coms in the 90s, but everybody was run on Sun. Sun Microsystems. Dot in .com. That was, right, the Ultra Sparks. You know, we had them at our desktop in the computer labs. It's cool. But that they were extremely expensive. SGI, yeah.
Was that, was that really their slogan? We put the dot in .com?
That was Sun's, right? Sun Microsystems said, we put the dot in .com. I thought that was like a, you know, you can fact check me, but I think it was like 1998, 1999 era, because it was like expensive to run servers. And like, you know, what is a cloud? There was no cloud. It was like, you have to actually rack these things yourself. And it was kind of
what was the Levi slogan back in the 1890s?
I don't know. What is it?
No, I'm just kidding.
This is well known.
No, I'm just calling you. Sorry. Okay. Levi's for the gold rush, you know.
No, but one of the interesting innovations, it was kind of a circumstance of the scale required, is that, you know, running these servers was really expensive and racking and buying these things. So Google kind of just haphazardly figured out, oh, you can just like use these old x86 Linux, build your own data center kind of like on a shoestring, and most of the hardware can be ready to fail. Like we don't need five nines uptime. We're going to trust in hardware that actually we expect to fail. And then we're just going to design a process that allows it to fail and allows us to replace it at the right time. Mm. To me, that's kind of what Sail Research is doing. They're saying, hey, instead of needing always frontier, fastest time to first token and best performance and stuff, you just say like, hey, we don't care. You show me any chip and we can find a workload that's going to fit that chip. And it could be a long horizon task. And it could be that it has very low uptime, or, you know, it's only 95% uptime or 90% uptime. That would never work in most situations where, like you mentioned, the solar, you know, you kind of, maybe it's only available half the day, but you have all these different places where you could actually run the workloads then.
Yeah.
And to me, it feels like very analogous to that kind of late 90s transition, that you actually come up with a whole new way to think about, you know, price per token and generating tokens.
I love that. And in fact, you know, maybe again, I mean, we'll love to get the Sail Research guy involved with this, but I do think there's really interesting business opportunities. And this is something I've been thinking about, you know, I've been thinking, as you know, around a solar incubation out of Hivemind for some time. I think there's a really, really interesting opportunity for basically building a new cloud. And if someone's listening to this and you're the person that wants to do this, you know, hit me up. But I think the sort of like, renewable solar or wind powered cloud where you just use the cheapest chips humanly possible, and you're just like, we are the low cost provider. Like we're, you know, we are the dollar store of clouds, but like we're ridiculously cheap and we can get power online ridiculously fast. I think the key is like how much of that sort of like old school depreciated supply is there? Because this is like, you know, back in the day in 21, the modeling we're trying to do with the Bitcoin mining, it's like it didn't make sense yet because the top of the line ASICs still, we didn't have enough the depreciated GPU or the ASICs yet to make it make work, to make it make sense. But then the next layer of where I think all of this is going is, you know, eventually I do think it has to come back to Bitcoin. Like the more open market is going to win eventually. And so someone that can build this protocol, maybe it's what Open Agents is doing, maybe it's what Steve, your dude, your friend at or whatever colleague at Block is doing.
Mesh LLM thing.
With Mesh, yeah, with Mesh LLM. But like I also think eventually what he's really doing is just pointing towards, in a shocking turn of events, the thing that always works, free markets. And so if eventually what's going to happen is everything he's saying is true, but it's going to go even more extreme, I believe, which is you're just going to have free markets for electrons converted into computation. And another piece of that is going to be the Bitcoin mining. And so that's going to be the floor. His thing is going to be right above the floor. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have the super high end stuff. So it's going to be this like cake. And someone's going to build the orchestration software or maybe the actual physical co-located hardware where you've got the solar and then the, you know, the GPUs and the ASICs. Somehow this is all going to come together.
Yeah. And also kind of to double down on these ideas you're discussing, I mentioned in the chat briefly, but I don't know if you've explored this, but have you seen Dark Bloom?
I don't even know what that is.
Wait, Steve, you've seen it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I shared it in the wrong chat. Sorry.
What's Dark Bloom? Give us the like we need 10 second TLDR.
We need to wrap up soon. So.
Okay.
But yeah. Just the 30 second TLDR.
I'll give you the TLDR. Dark Bloom started, I think it went viral on Hacker News or something like a week ago today. It's a way to get you can take a Mac on your own.
Oh, right.
And you can contribute it to a network and you can get paid for hosting inference on your local Mac.
I love it.
And so in a sense, it's kind of like a more of a direct monetized business model, kind of like what Mesh LLM is getting at, but it does it with very direct dollars today. So people could go out and even, you know, take a Mac that you have offline, bring it back online and start making money with it. Or maybe you could go buy a new Mac.
Who's behind this? And is there like some kind of shitcoin or is it like...
No. It's not. You just pay USD. It's just a business model behind bringing your own inference online and contributing to a decentralized inference cloud.
So you say, but it is from Eigen Labs, which is like, I think they're like Ethereum-y people. So hopefully
I don't know kind of the background of...
We talked about it in February, but anyway.
Yeah.
We got to wrap. We'll talk about it more in another episode.
Yeah. Anyways, all that to say a lot happening in the world. So...
Yes.
All right.
Never a dull moment.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
See you next week.